in the book of Exodus as we continue our series, Exodus chapter 2. Exodus chapter 2. Go ahead and find your way there. This is week number 2 of our journey here and in this series. This, you know, you might be familiar with origin stories, right? Every good comic book character, every good superhero has a good origin story, right? So sometimes when they come out with the new superhero movies, they're going to have an origin story in there, right? And tell you how that hero came to be, when he got bit by the spider or when his spaceship landed or whatever it might be, a good origin story. And when you get an origin story, you know it's an important person, right? People don't really, I don't know about you, but my origin story hasn't sold any books or anything like that, right? And so there's got to be something unique about you, right, for people to care much about your origin story, it seems. Well, in Exodus chapter 2, we get the origin story of one of the most significant characters in human history, and that is Moses, the human character in the book of Exodus that is obviously the most significant is Moses. And Scripture speaks much of Moses. Moses wrote much, as we know, of the Old Testament. The book we're reading, we believe to be written by Moses, the Pentateuch, Exodus. And so Moses was the one that God gave the law to. Moses was the one on Mount Sinai, the Ten Commandments that he comes down with, right? It wasn't Charleston Heston. It was Moses, and who comes down the mountain with those Ten Commandments, who walks and the Red Sea splits, and Israel walks through on dry ground. We'll get to that. But a significant person in the history of the world. I mean, Christianity aside, in history of the world, is this person. Today in Exodus 2, you get his birth story, okay? And so there's always, sometimes, many times, with significant people like this in Scripture, as we know, there's sometimes a unique birth story about this person. Just kind of a quick review in the book of Exodus. God's people are enslaved in Egypt. We looked at that last week in chapter 1. Prior to all this, Jacob's son Joseph had been sold into slavery. He had been arrested. He had been put in prison. And he had ultimately, because of his ability given by God to interpret dreams, had found himself as the right-hand man to Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. Famine's coming into the land. Things are going to be bad. Joseph is able to tell Pharaoh this, interpret his dream for him, and tell him how to get through it. That's all in the book of Genesis, right? The end of the book. And Exodus is the follow-up to Genesis. I told you last week, people note how the first Hebrew word in Exodus is "and," because it's a continuation of the story of Genesis. And so Joseph is able to do that. His brothers are all able to be saved from this famine. They all moved to Egypt. Joseph reveals that he is their brother, and that he's not dead, and that he hasn't disappeared off the face of the earth, but he has actually been promoted, and he's like right-hand man to the most powerful person in the world at that time, Pharaoh, the Pharaoh of Egypt, the king of Egypt. But when you get to Exodus, many years have passed. There's a new Pharaoh in town, so to speak, and he doesn't really care about Joseph, doesn't really remember anything about Joseph. Joseph was an important figure to the Egyptians. He didn't just save Israel. He helped save Egypt. But now, this Pharaoh doesn't care about that. And all he's doing is he's looking around and you go, you know, ever since these Israelites moved here many years ago, they keep reproducing and there's more of them than there are us now. And he decides, you know, we got to keep these people in check. We don't need another country coming to invade us. And then they decide to side with the other country and that could be bad for us. And so he ends up oppressing and even enslaving them. And Exodus is the story of God rescuing his people, being enslaved there for about 400 years. And he leads them out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, and ultimately, you know, gives them makes the covenant there, gives them the law, the Mosaic covenant there. And Moses leads them right up, ultimately, this character does, to the promised land. But if you know the story, Moses doesn't get to enter the promised land because of sin in his own life. But God does get his people to the promised land, and Moses is a key figure in that. He's the key figure in the book of Exodus. So let's look at his birth story here in Exodus chapter 2. Let's read verses 1 through 10. Now, a man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket made of bulrushes and daubed it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds by the riverbank. And his sister stood at a distance to know what would be done to him. Now, The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river, while her young women walked beside the river and sent her servant woman, and she took it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the baby was crying, and she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." So the girl went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I'll give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. When the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses because, she said, "I drew him out of the water." So the story here should remind us, as we look at this story, it's an amazing story when you consider the context of chapter 1, and we will talk a little bit about that again here in a moment. It's an amazing rescue story, and it's a story that reminds us, as we face problems in our day, as Moses' parents faced in their day, that our role, like their role was in their day, is to be faith-filled in our plan to trust God to accomplish His purposes. And we see the purpose of God prevailing here in these 10 verses. So let's kind of walk through this together. Number one, I want to talk to you about an urgent problem. And that's right there in verse 1 and verse 2. A man from the house of Levi went and took as his wife a Levite woman, and the woman conceived and bore a son. You read that, and you say, that don't sound like a problem. Well, the son's, the marriage is not the problem. The birth of the son's not a problem. Those are all good things. We throw parties for those things, right? We throw a party when a marriage happens, usually. We throw parties when a child is born and conceived and born. Those are good things. But in the context of Exodus, the problem is the death sentence that hangs over the child that has been conceived. We talked about their slavery here at the beginning, but not only that, as we know, Exodus 1:22, as Exodus ends, goes past slavery to the attempt at genocide as Pharaoh decides to keep these people from reproducing too much, all the boys that are born, they will be put to death. To get the Hebrew midwives to do this, they're unwilling to participate in this, and so ultimately he tells all of his people, he says, "This is what I want to happen when a newborn boy from Israel is born, from the Israelites is born. I want him tossed in the Nile River." He says here in chapter 1, verse 22, Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews, you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." And we talk, what's his big fear? Military, right? That they would join a military and fight against it. Well, he's going to take out the men before they're ever men. He's going to slow down the reproduction process, all of these sort of things. He is trying to ultimately wipe them out over time. Now, so imagine being the parents of this baby boy. The scriptures tell us the mother's name was Jochebed, and the father's name was Amram, A-M-R-A-M. And at this point, it seems that they at least had two children already. So they had a daughter named Miriam. She pops up again later in Exodus. And they have a son named Aaron. He was about 3 years older, we believe, than Moses. And so Aaron had been born before this edict had come down, it would seem. And so, but now there's this edict that has come down, this evil edict from the king. And she had no way of knowing when she's pregnant whether this is a boy or whether this is a girl. They didn't have the ultrasounds and the sonogram, all that kind of stuff that we have in our day. They had no way of knowing. And so, but there's 50-50 shot here that this could be a very tenuous thing. So you can imagine this was probably a very stressful pregnancy. And then the baby is born, and it is a boy. And you can imagine the feeling that came over them as they tried to figure out how to deal with the challenges they had to deal with. And here's the thing. Moses' parents had no control over the circumstances of their day or the challenges of their day. Zero. They had no power over. They're an enslaved people. And we don't always get to choose. Some circumstances in life we simply can't change. We're all dealt certain challenges and circumstances from time to time that we have zero control over. Beliefs, our values, who we are, our choices be dictated by our circumstances, by the challenges we face. Our faith and not our circumstances are to inform our decisions as we go through challenges and circumstances we face in life, just as we see theirs did. We can always find others who have better circumstances than us, and we can find others with worse circumstances than us, but the question is always, what will we do with the circumstances and challenges we face? And that's what they had to decide as they dealt with this problem. And here's the thing, a culture plagued by sin will create challenges for people of faith. And theirs created one. And the root cause of the culture, and the Egyptian culture in their day, was sin. And it manifested, the clear sin we see was the enslavement and the oppression and ultimately the murder and the attempted genocide of these people. That was kind of some of the ways that it manifested. And there's other ways, idolatrous ways. There's other ways that the evil man, and it manifests itself in our day, right? We have our own manifestations of evil in our own culture. We live in a fallen world, right? Sometimes in a fallen world, things that shouldn't be a challenge are a challenge because we're in a fallen world. It shouldn't be a challenge for newlyweds to have a baby and bring their boy into the world. That shouldn't be a challenge. But in a fallen world, it can be. In a broken world, it can be. And in a broken world, even things that should be celebrated or that should be, man, the whole community should celebrate it, sometimes that's not the case. And so they encountered an urgent problem. And secondly, I want you to look at the family's plan. There was a plan here, and it was a family plan. We see here, Exodus highlights the mother. The New Testament says the parents. We also see Miriam is involved, right? So Jochebed notices something. She notices, it says here in the text, that this child is a quote-unquote fine child. Now, what does this mean? What does this mean? Does it mean that she only wanted to save her child because he was good-looking? I don't think that's the point. I don't think that's the point at all, obviously. And what mother wouldn't do that, right? And think that, this is Douglas of the New American Commentary writes, quote, "The Hebrew idiom used here actually means to care about and to be fond of or to want to have or to keep." And so the verse is better translated according to him, quote, "She became pregnant and gave birth to a son. Longing to have or keep him, she hid him for 3 months." So I might get if it's a better idea. Another commentator by the name of Peter Enns, he refers to another scholar's interpretation of how all the way through Exodus you see connection back to the creation story in Genesis. We talked some about that last week. It will show up a little bit in the plagues as well. And so he notes when she says when she saw a fine child that it's very similar to in the Hebrew when God created and God said that it was good, right? And so you've got some keys here of what's going on here. This is more than just, oh, isn't he cute? Let's keep him. That's a little bit more than that, right? That's at play here. Acts 7:20 in the New Testament. We use the New Testament to help us understand the Old Testament because we interpret the Old Testament through the lens of Christ. And Acts 7:20 says, "At this time Moses was born." This is the story before he is put to death. He is recounting the story as he preaches. And he says, "Moses was born and he was beautiful in God's sight." And that gives us an idea, maybe. "And he was brought up for 3 months in his father's house." And maybe there was something about him that his parents and his mom knew, there was something significant about him. But Moses' parents hid him for 3 months. And that's part one of the plan. Let's just hide him, right? What else can we do? So they're hiding him. They get away with this for 3 months, right? They're able to do this. We don't know how. It doesn't tell us how. They simply knew, they did the first right thing they knew was the right thing. And they hid the child. They did not know what each step would be. And they did what parents naturally do, and a good parent naturally seeks to protect their child. "And she could hide him no longer," it says. "When she could hide him no longer, she took for him a basket." So there came a point when this baby could not be hidden anymore. And the text doesn't tell us why, but as he grew, it became more and more difficult to effectively hide him. "And she places him in a basket in the reeds on the riverbank." Now, earlier, he notes that the plan was probably to place him, he paints the picture that it's probably not that she put him in this basket and said, "Good luck," and just like ran away. But she was probably hiding him there during points of the day when these people were around that she was afraid that would turn her in. And so she would hide him in the reeds and probably go back and nurse him and retrieve him. And she had constructed a way not to float him across the river, but to hide him in the reeds, so that she could keep a watch on him, and so that hopefully he wouldn't be discovered. He even notes how they were probably hoping that the noise of the river and the activity around it would muffle cries and things, and this basket would be used to help muffle these things. And so this was the plan, and as we can see, it seems that the daughter had a part in the plan to keep watch over him, what's going on, and keep an eye on him. But I want you to note a couple things about the plan. And we use this from Hebrews 11:23. It tells us a little bit more about it. In Hebrews chapter 11, there's the hall of faith. When the Bible recounts the greats of the Old Testament, so to speak, right? The people, the heroes, the hall of faith, and how they lived by faith. And it talks about Moses, but it also talks about Moses' parents. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. They had a faith-filled plan. They did this by faith. It was faith and their faith and trust in God that motivated them to hide this child and to begin to enact this plan of preserving and protecting his life. They trusted God. They believed God. They relied on God. They were people of faith. And you can see a hint of that probably in the basket that they used to hide him. Inns and others, I believe, note that this basket in the Hebrew is the same as the word for ark. Two times in the Bible that it speaks of that Hebrew word for ark. The flood story and here. So certainly Moses probably would see this as an ark of safety, right? Same type thing, the danger of water, the ark of safety, God's people and newness on the other side and a renewal of God's people on the other side of all of this, on the other side of Noah, on the other side of Moses. Certainly Moses wants you to see that, but maybe also, maybe even his mom, she would have been familiar with this story. How was Moses able to write down the creation story for us? Because it had been told and passed down from generation to generation. And she would have known the story, most likely, of Noah. And so it could be that in constructing this ark for her son, that even that is a demonstration of her faith. We are to operate by faith. And when we operate by faith, we will at times find ourselves running opposed to the current of the world and its culture. And simply by living by faith, they find themselves at odds with the Egyptian culture of their day, which were not followers of the one true God, which did not love their neighbor as theirself, which did not have any desire to keep these people alive, much less do anything to honor them or protect her child. They wanted her child dead. And so simply by living by faith and doing what she knew to be right, she was going to be running counterculture. That was just the way it was going to be. I mean, the current was going this way. She was going this way. And listen, it's difficult, by the way, to walk upstream, right? Salmon swim upstream, right? You go to a water park, get in the lazy river, lose your float. You might have to walk upstream and get another one for a little bit. That's difficult, by the way, if you ever tried to do that. But when the water's going this way and you're trying to go this way, that's difficult. And it's similarly in culture. When sin and corruption and greed and all, you know, and the fallen nature of this world is flowing this way, and you say, well, I'm going to walk by faith and I'm going to go this way, that's going to be a challenge. That is the state of things. When your spiritual condition is different than the spiritual condition of the world around you, that's going to create challenges. And so it requires a second component, faith and, what you notice about their plan. It was a courageous plan. And Hebrews tells us they did not fear this evil thing that had come down from Pharaoh, this indictment that, hey, this edict that, hey, you've got to put these children to death. They just didn't fear. They knew what the consequences could be for disobedience. Maybe it'd mean their death. So they were courageous because they feared God more than they feared the king, and they loved their child more than they loved their own lives. Faith and courage are two ingredients to living obediently in an immoral culture. We have to be willing to trust God, that He knows what's best, to obey Him, knowing that it's worth it, and we have to be willing to take courage, to not cower in fear in the face of our circumstances and temptations and trials and the challenges that we face. It takes faith and courage to parent in every generation. It took faith and courage to be a parent in their generation. It takes faith and courage to be a parent in this generation and the one before it and the one before it, because if you're going to parent, you're going to parent by faith, you're going to parent in a culture used to your values. Every generation has their challenges, and believers are to approach their generation with faith and courage. And when we do that, that's when we can really begin to impact the people around us. That's when we can really stand out, salt and light, right? That's when we can really stand out in the world, is when we're the ones walking upstream from the culture, when we're the ones living by faith and taking courage when nobody else will. Like, and sometimes you need to see that, right? Sometimes you need to see, believers, we need to see, it's part of the discipleship process. We need to see other people live by faith. We read about it in the book, right? But we need to see it lived out. It helps you to see someone deal with their, you know, what their challenge over here with their child, their challenge in their marriage, and their challenge in their job, and their health challenge, and their aging challenge, and all these different challenges, these human challenges we go through. When you see people deal with them with faith and courage, it helps you. It helps your own discipleship process. Look, I've never been a big fan of math, but I can tell you this, it's a lot easier to learn if you've got a whiteboard or you've got a pencil and paper and you're working it out and you can see it than it is to learn that strictly auditory, right? You want to learn math with just sitting there and I'm just going to tell you all the facts? No pencil, no paper, right? That would be very difficult. You can learn some things that way. You might learn some history that way, but you're not going to learn math that way. You've got to see it. You've got to see it. And similarly, in the Christian life, part of the discipleship process, we need to see it sometimes worked out on the whiteboard, on the chalkboard, right? Generation, speak to all generations this morning. You have to see it worked out. What does that look like? And we can look in the Old Testament. We can look at Moses' mother and Moses' dad and Miriam, and we can look and we can say, oh, there it is. And you can look, and we can also look at people in our lives who live by faith, as imperfectly as we are, and say, oh, there, I see it. And it's an important part of this as we live. This family had a plan, and that plan was a faith-filled plan, a courageous plan to live for God in the midst of a godless culture. Let me just tell you, you better have a plan. You better have a plan for the challenges you're going to face. You better have a plan for how you're going to face the challenges and the difficulties that are going to come your way, our way, in the midst of a culture that is plagued by sin. But at the end of the day, our plans only go so far. And we have to trust that God's purpose is going to prevail. And the third piece we see here is a divine purpose on display. At some point, their plan is undone. Let me tell you what part of their plan was not. Part of their plan was not Pharaoh's daughter finding the little baby boy in the basket in the reeds. Not part of their plan. Not at all. Not at all. In fact, that probably in the moment seemed like one of the worst things that could possibly happen. But he's discovered. But even in this, what we're going to see is while that was not probably part of their plan at all, it did end up serving the greater purpose of God. And when you step back and look, what you'll see is God clearly had a purpose from the beginning. And while we know the whole story now, we know who Moses grows up to be, but at the time they don't know all this. And if you're just reading this for the first time, starting in Exodus 1, and you're making your way through, right, you're kind of captivated by this. And what is happening is God is doing things in such a way that it is miraculous and showing that he is showing favor to his people and that he will thwart the evil of Pharaoh. And in so doing, ultimately, he's going to judge Egypt for their evil. And we're kind of getting foretaste of this and what is going down in the birth of Moses and how things are happening. Let's notice a few things here revealing the purpose of God. Notice that God chose a son to deliver the Israelites. And he chose a son at this particular time. Now, God could have raised up a woman if he wanted to. He chose a son. Who did Pharaoh say he was going to kill? Really? I'm going to pick one of them. Right? I'm going to pick someone. And I'm not going to pick just any son. That's not really about Aaron. It's not really about, he's not a teenager right now. I'm going to pick one under your death sentence. And I'm going to see to it that he survives your death sentence, because that's who I'm going to use to ultimately deliver my people and bring judgment against you. He chose a son. And God will use Moses to powerfully display his plans and purposes, and that they are greater than Pharaoh's. And God will show Pharaoh that it is he, not Pharaoh, that is the ultimate sovereign. And that's an amazing thing, that Pharaoh's purpose is to wipe out all the Israelite baby boys, and God's purpose is to set his people free, and he chooses to use the exact type of person that Pharaoh wanted dead. So God chooses a son, and he chooses a son of a particular age, and God chose to work through Pharaoh's daughter. Now, we don't know how many daughters Pharaoh had and how many wives he had or any of that, but God chose to use one of the candidates on all the earth at that time to be a part of this. Now, if you're Moses' mother, and you could make a list of people that you would hope would not discover that little ark in the water on any given day that you put it out there as you prayed, my guess is Pharaoh is at the top of the list and his family is next. Of all the people that I don't want to discover this ark, Lord, please don't let it be Pharaoh. Please don't let it be one of his sons or daughters. Please don't let it be, you know, there's probably, those are the people that you would assume would be the most loyal to him. Don't let them find this ark. God could have chosen to work through anyone. God could have chosen to just somehow sovereignly protect. And for people to just never discover him, and for them to just kind of, till he got to a certain age where they didn't realize it was on the other side of the ruling that had come down. I mean, God could have chosen to do this a myriad of ways, but God didn't choose to do it that way. God said, no, no, you know what? Let's let Pharaoh's daughter. Scholars point out that because of this, Moses got an Egyptian education. He's an Israelite, but he's raised an Egyptian. He begins to understand both worlds. He's put in a unique position in life that really no Egyptian was in and really no other Israelite was in. He is unique in his world at that time because God has a purpose for Moses, and we're going to see that play out. And then I want you to notice that he was drawn from the water. Verse 10, when the child grew older, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son, and she named him Moses because, she said, I drew him out of the water. Right? So it's significant to her. Seems to be significant to Moses, who's telling us this, and it's significant to the story. You know, the ESV Study Bible, that I've mentioned, great study Bible, helps explain Moses' name here. And because commentators go around and around about this, the Hebrew versus the Egyptian, and the name Moses in the Hebrew pronunciation sounds like the verb to draw out. As the said, the name may be connected to the word for son. So people are like, you know. So she drew her son out of the water, and it seems that she named him in a way that reflects that. However, the name points to the very, in God's sovereignty, this Egyptian lady gave this name to a son that points to the very destiny of Moses, and she didn't even know it. The writers of the study Bible, the ESV study Bible, note that the dual reference in the word son and in the word draw out, and that the Egyptian and the Hebrew there, points to, ultimately, God drawing Israel out as his son. When you get over to Hosea, you know, sometimes Israel is referred to as God's son, right? He talks about Israel, my son, right? It's his child that he will protect. And in Hosea 11:1, a prophecy is given. It just says, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son, right? And so you see some ties here between Moses and Israel. As Moses shall go, Israel shall go, right? He's the leader. And there is the place of death for the Israelites. I mean, if you're an Israelite, you walk by the Nile River and you get the... This is where they drowned small children. It's a place of, I mean, evil, wickedness. This is where Pharaoh has demanded this. And Moses' mother places him there. In this place of death, in the ark, the scariest, most dreaded place, and God rescues him through the means of Pharaoh's daughter right there from the river. Because, see, God's purpose for Moses is tied to God's purpose for Israel. And just as Moses passed through the water, so shall Israel. They too shall be brought to safety, and ultimately through the Red Sea. The water shall become a place of death for Egypt. It shall become a place of life for Israel. The story is going to be completely turned on its head in about 13 more chapters, where all of a sudden, water meant death for Israel, but water is going to mean life for Israel, and water is going to mean death for Egypt. Peter Enns, who I quoted earlier, notes how God does this and notes how God's power is at work in Moses' life, and he says this. He says, Moses' infancy, this is a quote, infancy, his death and his rebirth on the Nile, as you can see here, as he's placed in the water, not knowing what's going to happen, and discovered is itself a microcosm of the people's plight as a whole. And as their leader, he experiences what the Israelites will experience later on. Because he is symbolic, and he is the leader. And it's like his birth is prophetic in a sense, right? It's like it's a living parable, or whatever you might want to call it. A story being told before the story, showing us what's to come. And whereas Pharaoh aimed to drown these people in the water, Moses is ultimately drawn out. And God is going to draw not only Moses out of the water, he's going to raise him up to be the leader that draws Israel out of Egypt through the water. So through these verses, we get foreshadowings that Moses is an important figure and use him in a particular and mighty way. Because God can take a child with small chances of survival, and he can take a child that is discovered by the family of a murderous king, and he can rescue him. He can place him in the king's daughter's family. He can raise that child to be a leader who leads people out of his people out of slavery. God can do that. And while Pharaoh had a plan, it would be trumped by God's purpose. Pharaoh would learn it's not he but God who is ultimately in control. He can't thwart God's plan. And while Moses' parents had a plan, their plan would ultimately get them so far. But God's purpose would prevail. Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many are the plans in the minds of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand." We can plan, and we should plan, and we should walk by faith, but we have to understand ultimately it's the purpose of God that's the sure thing. And God has a purpose for his people, and God will accomplish the purpose for his people. And this is just another demonstration of that. And God's saving purposes cannot be thwarted. He saw Israel through Egypt, and he can see you through this world. He delivered Israel. He shall deliver us. And listen, God's not desperate. God's in control. He's not desperate. And you might look at this. You might read this. We've got to be careful that we don't think of God as like, it's kind of like, you know, college football started back this weekend. And, you know, you think of a team down by 3 touchdowns, right, or, you know, whatever, down by a touchdown, 2 minutes to go, and, you know, now all of a sudden the clock's wound down, and there's 5 seconds on the clock, and they're at the 50-yard line, and they're just throwing up the Hail Mary, in all the hopes of tying or scoring the winning touchdown. And if we're not careful, we'll look at some situations in life and circumstances, and the Bible can even read this way, where it's almost kind of like God's just crossing his fingers. And he's throwing up the Hail Mary. But what Scripture should certainly teach us is that is not the case at all. God doesn't throw Hail Marys. He doesn't need Hail Marys. He is in control. This is all part of the plan. In a way that will glorify him and will ultimately accomplish his purpose for his people. Even when it doesn't feel like it. Even when it doesn't seem like it. I imagine if you were in Israel, if you were in Egypt this time and you were an Israelite, it was beyond difficult. We haven't lived through the type of thing that these people were having to live through. Can you imagine? But yet God was in control. And God had a plan. And deliverance was coming. And salvation was coming. And ultimately, thousands of years later, the Messiah was coming. And we have to keep in mind, as we go through our world, that God is always in control. And even when it doesn't seem like it, God doesn't need a Hail Mary. And that ultimately God is going to deliver his people. And ultimately the Messiah is going to return. And ultimately everything's going to be okay. And our role, like Moses' parents here, is to walk by faith. To trust God, to obey God, to walk by faith, and see the purposes of God unfold. Listen, God be like Christ. That's his ultimate purpose for us. For us to grow into the kind of people that he has saved us to be. And he can use all kinds of circumstances, challenges. He uses those things. Difficulties we go through, he uses those things because that's his ultimate purpose for us. His ultimate purpose for us is not a particular career. It's not a particular level of influence or wealth. That's not his ultimate purpose for us. All those things are means that God uses to accomplish his purpose for us and in us, which is to be like Christ and to glorify him and to know him and to worship him and to be sanctified and to grow and to mature. And so God's purpose for you right now in this life, believer, is to become more like Christ, to become sanctified more and more, and ultimately one day to be with him. And we're going to go through all kinds of stuff between here and there that God can use in that process. But God will accomplish his purpose as sure as he took Moses out of the river and Pharaoh's household. He can do it. And Moses' story is meant to point us forward to Christ, where God's ultimate saving purpose is revealed. He'd think about the birth of Christ. He would be born to a virgin in a manger. His mom would face difficult circumstances as well. Moses was under a death sentence given by Pharaoh. Jesus would be put under a death sentence given by Herod, where Herod would aim to kill everybody two and under in hopes of taking out the one born king of the Jews. And like Israel, Jesus' family would flee to, they would flee Egypt. Matthew 2, 14 and 15. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt, and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. The story of Moses and the story of Israel in Egypt and God calling that, you say, oh, we've got God already out of Egypt, right, called his son. He called Israel out of Egypt. Yes, he did, and it's a foretaste of something else that was coming when God ultimately would send his son into Egypt to protect him and then call him out. Moses would be chosen by God to help deliver his people from physical bondage. Jesus was sent and was born to lead his people from spiritual bondage. Jesus would live sinlessly. He'd fulfill the law. God would hand down the law to Moses and say, this is how you're supposed to live. This is what it looks like to walk with me. And all of us would fail to do it. And then Jesus would come along and perfectly fulfill it. And the way out of spiritual bondage is still to this day through Jesus, the one who perfectly fulfilled the law, who laid down his life on the cross, dying for sinners in our place, and has been risen from the dead. And he is the way to freedom. And Moses and the Exodus points us to him, the ultimate deliverer, who the Bible says all God's promises find their yes in him. So let me ask you this morning as we close, have you found your purpose in Christ today? If you want to know God's will for your life, it starts with a relationship with God through Jesus, period. And as a believer this morning,